you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Mm-hmm. Can I get you something?
It's your mofo butter-laying into the bone, jacking me up. Tight me.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Cutty say can't hang.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
Oh, good.
He said that he's in great pain and he wants to know if you can help him.
All right.
It's Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross with a little preview of a segment that's coming up in just a few minutes. We're going to dig into the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. They have released their first 10 words. But thanks so much for joining us on air and live streaming on Instagram at LAIST Official. That's LAIST Official. You can join the conversation there and play the once weekly game. Guess what your host looks like? And then see how close you got. Coming up also, we have a very interesting young man on the show. And he wrote an op-ed saying that fellow Gen Zers may be confusing mental health issues with normal daily discomforts. And that's a lot. This kid is 17 years old and he's saying that. And he knows a thing or two about it because he's also the son of a therapist. So I'm really looking forward to that. We're going to hear from him and take your calls. I want to hear your thoughts on this one in just about 20 minutes. But we start today with the latest on continuing negotiations in Washington, D.C. over the debt ceiling. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said this morning that negotiators made progress on a deal with the White House to raise the debt limit. This, as they race to close out a deal ahead of a looming deadline to avert a potentially catastrophic default. McCarthy told reporters at the Capitol that there is still more work to do, and the two sides are narrowing in on a two-year agreement that could potentially curb federal spending and lift the borrowing limit ahead of the deadline, which could happen as soon as June 1st. Joining us with the latest is Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, thanks so much for making the time.
Good to be with you.
Always great day when we have Ron Elving on. So, tale as old as time here in these negotiations, Ron, because Republicans, they want the deep spending cuts to government spending programs that Dems feel go too far. So, talk us through some of the specific sticking points. I understand one of them has to do with the IRS.
Yes, it appears that a major concession being made by the Biden administration here is to cut way back on the extra funding approved in the last couple of years for the IRS. Now, the government has had a hard time collecting money over a number of years because of antiquated computer systems, and I'm sure anyone who does their own taxes can tell you just how hard it got there for years to get through the process. And the IRS needs more money for more agents and so on. And if you believe that we should be collecting all the taxes that are levied, especially from those people who have the most money, you want to see that work because that means less tax that we theoretically paid by everybody else. And it's been hard. It's been a hard slog for the IRS. So the administration went for a really big increase in funding for the IRS, and that is anathema to anti-tax conservatives in the Republican Party who, for many years, even before Ronald Reagan, made the taxes and the collection of taxes a major issue. They have been anti-IRS for a number of decades now, and they really hated that funding and represented it to their constituency as being federal agents coming after you, as opposed to just, you know, computers and more agents to go after people who have been avoiding taxes.
Ron, for people who have been following NPR for a number of years, too, there's a bit of a backstory with the GOP and the IRS. I understand that the IRS had to apologize for scrutinizing some conservative groups about five, 6 years ago or so, right? So you could kind of see this still as a result of that, couldn't you?
Yes, there was evidence in the years right after the Tea Party election of 2010 that the IRS had targeted any organization that had Tea Party in its name. to see whether or not they were violating the campaign finance laws with respect to their tax exemption. So there was a good deal of that kind of investigation going on. Some people would say it was justified. Obviously, a lot of Republicans thought it was persecution. And so they have been more or less on the warpath and looking for scalps they could take with regard to that ever since.
Talking right now with Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent for NPR, and streaming live on Instagram right now at LAist Official if you want to join in on the conversation there. Ron, deadlines typically create action, but part of what's made these talks tough is that there isn't a precise date when we would default. I just know that Treasury Secretary Yellen has said next week is the earliest we could reach it. Do you think that Republicans are working based off of that assumption?
There are two deadlines, actually, here. Okay. One of them, of course, is the default date. The other, and I hate to be cynical here, but the other is a Memorial Day holiday. Mm. And the fact that the House was not really planning to be around to do normal business, and is not today, and the negotiators are here and some of the leaders, and they're going to be gone for this holiday, and McCarthy told them they could go, but to stay on 24-hour alert and be in a position to return to Washington on very short notice. Hopefully there will be a deal in the next 48 or 72 hours, if not sooner, and they can bring everybody back on Tuesday next week to vote on it, because McCarthy has also promised his people that they would not be asked to vote on anything that hadn't had an adequate amount of time to read. So theoretically, they're going to have 72 hours to read it and then vote in the House. Then they'll have to vote in the Senate. The Biden administration, or Joe Biden himself, would add his signature. And then the Treasury Department could proceed as normal. By then, certainly we will have passed June 1st. No question about that. Hmm. So if they had a deal and if they could expect that everything was going to get worked out in a matter of days, they might pass a very short-term extension of the debt ceiling, maybe just for a matter of days, maybe not even weeks.
So it's really getting down to the wire is what I'm hearing at this point, Ron.
Yes, the cash is not going to be there. And when the cash is not there, the Treasury is going to have to make choices about what bills to pay. The first bills they have to pay are those bonds that are coming due. That is the debt that we're trying to take care of. And those are largely paid automatically by computer. So that money is going to go out the door. And the Treasury Department will then not have cash to make good on all those other checks, including checks that go out to people who receive money for Medicare, people who receive money for Social Security. And that's when you're really going to hear from those constituents, when those checks aren't showing up. So most of everyone is now expecting that a deal will get done and that those checks will go out. But that is the big sword that's hanging over everybody's head.
So one of the sticking points, we mentioned voting earlier, one of the big sticking points potentially for Democrats is the possibility of increasing work requirements for government benefit programs. I know that progressive lawmakers, members of the Congressional Black Caucus, have said they would vote against a bill that strengthens work requirements, as many in the GOP have suggested. So it sounds to me like even though they come up with a potential deal, whipping everybody together to get them to vote for it could be a whole other saga for us, Ron.
Yes, it will be a saga, but that too is also going on as we speak, because in addition to the negotiators talking to each other, they are also talking to the leaders of the House and Senate in both parties and giving them some heads up as to what they're going to have to sell. Now, there is never going to be a plan that gets 100 votes in the Senate and that gets 435 votes in the House. That's not going to ever exist. So what we're expecting to see is a plan that can get a little over half of the Republicans in the House and a little over half the Democrats in the House, and similar figures in the Senate. But they probably are going to need to get to 60 in the Senate, but Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader there, seems to be on board to getting that done, and certainly Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, wants to get that done. So we don't have to have everyone to get the whole thing finally approved and heaved over. There are going to be holdouts in both parties. Maybe roughly three dozen in the House Republican caucus have made it pretty clear they don't want to see any compromise at all. And so they are going to vote against whatever deal gets done. And there are also a number of Democrats with highly legitimate concerns and things that are, one would say, the top priorities of Democratic legislators and campaign candidates. Those concerns are in many cases going to be bruised, and they're going to, in all likelihood, vote against whatever deal comes down. So the art here is to find enough votes in each party, in each chamber, to get it done.
Was it really important, Ron, you think, to take it down to the wire? Because my understanding leading up to this day was that, you know, clearly a big bargaining point, or I think one of the Congress members said, you know, what's Biden getting out of this, was the question posed to him. And he said, well, he's getting the debt deal done. But in return, they wanted so many different concessions. What role does this pressure that now everybody is feeling play in the overall deal-making process? It seems like we do this a lot.
You know, we got the debt ceiling during the negotiations that led up to the United States entering into the war. That is World War One in 1917. That's where this came from. And it was part of the deal then to get the opposition to that war to back down and to allow us to borrow money to participate in the First World War. We've had it now for over 100 years. And during that period of time, it has been raised, the debt ceiling, almost on an annual basis, more than 100 times, and more than once a year since 1980, and 18 times while Ronald Reagan was president. But most people have never really given it much thought because it really wasn't that big a dramatic deal. It was worked out, it had to be done, and the parties came to some sort of an agreement. But it has been used as leverage, if you will, hostage-taking as a tactic, just in very recent years. Newt Gingrich in the 1990s, then again after that Tea Party election I mentioned a moment ago, and now in the current situation with a brand new Republican majority in the House and a very narrow majority, which means that the most, if you will, radical members of that majority get to pretty much dictate an agenda to the Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, who, if he wants to remain Speaker, has to listen to them. That's where we are.
Yeah, I think people might recall how many votes it took to even get McCarthy in that place to begin with. We have a question from one of our listeners, Ron. Gina in Whittier says, there was a GOP legislator that said that the debt limit is a farce and that Biden just has to rearrange where the money is going and that we are not really at a default. Is that true? So that's Gina in Whittier. What do you think, Ron?
I don't think that that point of view holds much validity with respect to the way that our debt is issued and the way that our debt is honored. And here's the really important thing to bear in mind. A lot of this has to do with confidence, and there are rating agencies that rate the credit of the United States. And just on the threat of a default in 2011, we lost our AAA rating from one of the main rating services. That has cost billions and billions of dollars in extra interest in terms of the interest we have to pay to sell those bonds to people all over the world, including largely to Americans. So that is a real consequence of everything that's going on right now, and that is it's going to cost the United States more to borrow to service its debt. And I'm not talking about new debt. I'm not talking about something that's a result of current spending. I'm talking about the rolled-over debt from all the years, the Trump years, the Obama years, the Reagan years, the Bush years, all those years of debt, and the federal government runs a debt every year, runs a deficit every year, and that contributes to the debt. All of that accumulated debt has to be serviced. And as it has to be serviced at higher rates because we've lost our high bond rating, we pay the price. Every American taxpayer pays the price.
That's Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent for NPR, watching this story for us. Ron, thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you. Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
This is Air Talk Friday. I'm Austin Cross on air and on Instagram at LAist Official, where you can join in on the conversation there and see inside of Larry Mantle's Studio A, if you're ever wondering what it looks like. Today, it's your chance to get a sneak peek. When we come back, we are going to take a look at the African American English Dictionary. It's from Oxford. They're out with 10 of the words, 10 of the first words that have made the cut. We're going to talk about it and look back at the history of African American English. That's all ahead in just 60 seconds on Air Talk. Stick around.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on a Friday. Austin Cross with you on air and streaming live on Instagram at LAist Official if you want to join the conversation and see inside the great Studio A. African-American English. It has been a major influence on the English language as a whole. Much of the vocabulary we use today originates from African-American language. Now, a new project from Oxford University Press and Harvard aims to shed light on those contributions with a dictionary of African American English. Oxford releases the dictionary's first 10 definitions. That list includes words like bussin', grill, old school. Joining us to discuss the process of developing the new dictionary and the history of African American English is John Baugh, professor of linguistics and African American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He's also a member of the advisory board for the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. Professor, thank you so much for making the time.
Well, thank you, Austin. It's nice to be with you.
I also want to ask our listeners, what words do you think should be included, especially if you are from the African-American community? If there is a word that you grew up with or a word that you've come to use in day-to-day life, what is that word? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-893-5722. I think I have a few of my own as well, but give us a call, 866-893-5722. Well, Professor Baugh, there are often misconceptions about what African-American English is and isn't. So maybe just as a starter, can you explain what it is?
Yes, and thank you for that question. So African-American English, when we use that term, we're really speaking about the colloquial speech of urban or rural slave descendants of African origin. And so African Americans who may have moved here from Nigeria are not part of the group that we're considering when we're developing this dictionary. Hmm. When we talk about African American English, we're speaking about the linguistic legacy, the African slave trade, and the fact that when slaves encountered English on plantations, they did so very much by listening and learning to slave overseers, many of whom were white indentured servants from Scotland and Ireland who spoke with a brogue. And because they were denied access to schools, right? Slaves were not allowed to learn how to read or write by law, the organic evolution of the dialects of enslaved Africans began to fossilize. And then once those groups migrated to other areas, those forms were often preserved because once they left the South and moved to Detroit or New York or Philadelphia or Los Angeles, they were not integrated into other parts of the population. They were still segregated in those areas. So the linguistic isolation has had unique linguistic consequences. And then to the extent that there's contact between the groups, some of the words and expressions spill over, and that's what we're looking at in this dictionary.
I mean, one thing that's just so fascinating to me about how words evolved, especially from the time of slavery, is that a lot of words either morphed into other pronunciations or then they evolved to have a veiled meaning, sometimes to protect the safety of the actual people, right?
That is true. Because we are a team of advisors, there are some words know better than others, and then some colleagues are contributing in other ways. So you might end up accidentally stumping the expert here if you bring up an example that I don't know that well. But for the most part, I'm familiar with not only the 10 words that have been introduced, but, I can do some spoilers on words that are yet to come. I'll give you a very simple example of one.
Sure.
That's not in the dictionary yet, but will be there. And it's the usage of be in the expressions like we be happy. All right. Now, be is a perfectly good word in English used by all English speakers. But the unique usage of that be construction, where some people assume that it's being substituted for the word is misleading. So when a Black person says we be happy, that's usually a habitual state, meaning that they're happy all the time. And often a be or an is completely omitted, with we happy being a momentary expression. And so there's a very productive grammatical distinction between that usage of be, which many outsiders to the African-American community, when they hear that, their reaction is, well, that's wrong. That's ungrammatical. No, it's actually quite grammatical and extremely productive for those who are speakers of the dialect. And so that evolution, has its historical roots actually going back to the Scots-Irish examples, because the Irish would say things like the bucket done be over yonder. And the slaves heard that and thought, well, okay, I get it. And you had African pronunciations, and the bucket done be over yonder is, something that lingers today.
That's just so fascinating to me. But one thing that stood out to me, because I love to listen to old recordings, anything, even John Lomax did a bunch of recordings of folk music going way back into the 30s. But you listen to any old recording and you notice that people just spoke differently. And so part of my curiosity about this is if certain phrases or words are just regional things, because I know that with media, with social media, but also with the advent of radio, television, music, especially popular music, phonograph records, words, phrases could spread so much faster to so many more people than they might have if they were just in some backwoods somewhere, only spoken in a town of 1,000 people. So when it came to choosing the words for this dictionary, how did you decide what was worthy of getting added and what maybe was a close but not quite there? Like, what was the defining line?
That's a very good question, and it's a process. So your listeners are unaware of the fact that for many, many years, I was a member of the Usage Evaluation Committee for the American Heritage English Dictionary. And the dictionary, the Webster's Dictionary, the American Heritage Dictionary, Oxford's Dictionary for the English Language, those dictionaries that trace their history back to Samuel Johnson's original dictionary are looking at literate forms of English and spellings that, to our modern eyes look quite archaic. So the fact that Knights of the Round Table is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T is an indication that the word was pronounced differently when it was originally put into the dictionary, right? So the traditional dictionary, and why did we have a usage committee? We have a usage committee because meanings drift, meanings change. People, for example, the word disinterested and the word uninterested don't mean the same thing, but there's a lot of people that say them as if they mean the same thing, right? And so the usage committee will say, well, have these meanings merged in the everyday discourse of people, right? So that's the traditional dictionary. The Dictionary of African American English is looking at old linguistic contributions as well as fairly new linguistic contributions, right? So, for example, one of the words that's not in there yet is homeboy. All right. So homeboys were not on the plantation. All right. Homeboys.
Not quite.
Right. All right. So but homeboy is alive and well and used. And so the way that we make the decision is it's a process whereby typically a member of the advisory committee will introduce a suggestion along with their best assessment of what the definition and derivation of the word or phrase is. And then others chime in to, you know, evaluate what the expression may have meant originally and how it evolved over time. I'll give you an example.
Can I just ask you really quickly, though, about homeboy? Because it has morphed into homes, homie. Any sense really quickly of where that came from? Because it seems like two things. It's trying to describe something. It's home and it's a boy. Any sense of where that came from?
No. I know exactly where it came from. All right. So the expression homeboy actually came from incarcerated black prisoners.
Oh.
And what would happen is they would be in jail and someone who had been in jail for a while would see a new inmate who was younger, who grew up in their old neighborhood. And that was a boy from home.
Wow.
Who then became my homeboy. And so in prison, not only are the gangs divided by race, but homies are especially tight because you knew them growing up from back in the neighborhood. Then once the prisoners got back out into the general population, the term homeboy came with them, then homegirl, right? And so it's a term born of a special circumstance in prison.
Talking right now with John Baugh, professor of linguistics and African American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. And we're talking about the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. They have released their first 10 words. And we're, of course, asking our listeners, if there is a word, especially if you're from the black community, if there's a word that you grew up with, a word that you're very familiar with, that's taken on a meaning in your family, we'd love to hear from you. 866-893-5722 is the number. Again, that's 866-893-5722. Alexander in South LA says, if they don't put finna in there, then the dictionary is not accurate. Adam is calling us from Victorville. Adam, what do you think should be added to the dictionary, or what are you familiar with? Or do we have Adam on the line? Oh, there you are. Adam, start that again, because we just got you up on the line. But what is the word or phrase that you're thinking about?
Well, I grew up in the old school culture of hip hop, break dancing, and stuff. And I grew up with a lot of cultures. So the word, it means a lot. It means like, I agree, or are you serious, or I get it, or, you know, I understand. So just the word, and the way you say it.
Adam and Victorville pointing out the word. And I also want to point out a comment on our Instagram live feed that's at LAist Official. The Hood Fairy says, I think African-American English has a lot of words born out of special circumstances, and I hope there's some acknowledgement of that in the dictionary. Just to come back to you, Professor Baugh, do you think that, you know, certain words that appear in certain circumstances need to be explained a little bit more, especially if you plan to have them appear in the new dictionary?
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of what makes this project very special, because a word that evolves as a result of its usage on the plantation is going to be very different than what the caller just said, which is a more contemporary slang usage of word, you know, being said in as an affirmative response to a comment that someone else might have made, right? And so that needs to be explained and contextualized. And also, you've touched on something. right?
Hmm.
Because language is constantly undergoing change, but the spread of language has been influenced by technology, right? So prior to the advent of radio, the extent to which dialects were drifting tended to be based upon where people were in face-to-face contact with one another. Once you have radio and television, you're exposed to a variety of different dialects that are hundreds and thousands of miles away from your normal day-to-day speaking community. And so the linguistic exposure is far more rapid. In the age of social media, you know, they say that things go viral for a reason, right? Mm. Let alone people, you know, actually attempting to use social media as a means through which they can coin a linguistic innovation that they hope goes viral, that they get credit for. So we've watched linguistic change be modified as a result of technology over time. And Black slang is part of this, and especially in the age of Black Twitter.
You know, I want to ask you, Professor, Mary in Koreatown is asking about the term Ebonics, which I think that if you're of a certain age, that is probably a word that you grew up with that people used conversationally to describe the style of speaking that a lot of Black Americans have. Is Ebonics a term that's used ever in the linguistics world, or is it antiquated now?
Where does it fit? And Ebonics is woefully misunderstood, unfortunately. I'll try to give you the quickest snapshot and an accurate snapshot of the term Ebonics. So when linguists began to, this is an important thing. You may not be able to detect from my voice that I'm African American, but I'm the very first African American to get a PhD in linguistics from the University of Pennsylvania. And to place my age, I'm a boomer. And in fact, I'm from LA. I grew up in LA, initially lived near Crenshaw and Jefferson, and eventually moved out to the Valley. I graduated from Chatsworth High School, right?
Real local.
So I'm a local boy, and I did my linguistic research in Pacoima. So LA is my hometown. I love LA. I miss LA. I've got family still living there. but when the terminology that linguists used to describe the speech of slave descendants evolved over time. Your listeners, if they're old enough, may remember that the terms Negro and colored were once respectable terms. Mm-hmm. You can find videos of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King referring to Negro people, and they did so as if it was respectful. So linguists started talking, at least initially, about non-standard Negro English that evolved to Black English, then African-American vernacular English and African-American language. Along the way, a group of African-American social scientists who were not linguists said, wait a second, why are you all focused on English? Slavery happened in lots of places beyond the English-speaking places where slaves were sold, which is true. And so Robert Williams, who is my late colleague in African and African-American studies at Washington University, combined the words ebony and phonics. And the original definition of Ebonics was intended to describe the linguistic contact that resulted from the African slave trade. So Ebonics in Brazil is in contact with Portuguese. Ebonics in Haiti is in contact with French. Ebonics in the United States is in contact with English. But a lot of people assume that Ebonics is synonymous with African-American vernacular English, and it's not.
Talking right now with John Baugh, professor of linguistics and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. And we're very limited on time. I'm going to list out a few of the words that will be included. Bussin', which describes food. It's tasty, delicious. There's grill. That's a removable or permanent dental overlay. We also have words like promised land, chitterlings, kitchen, which is the hair at the nape of the neck. A lot of people might not know. Old school, the word pat, which means to tap your foot. But I want to ask you about a word
I want
that,
to correct you. You pronounced chitlins as it's spelled, but you'll have listeners say, wait a second, what did he say?
Yes, indeed.
Austin's talking about chitlins.
Ooh, mea culpa. Chitlins, my apologies.
No problem.
You know, it's not something that I grew up with, but I will say this. It's not something I ever really saw written. It's something that I heard talked about. How often do you spell it?
That's exactly right.
Or you spell it like it sounds.
It's spelled chitterlings, right?
Who even determined how it's spelled?
Right. But ain't nobody saying chitterlings.
No, ain't nobody saying that. I got to ask you this with the short time we have left, and it's a serious question, but it's got to come up because you talk about how deep this language goes, and it goes to, you know, slavery and the time of slavery. The N-word, it's very ugly, painful word that was used throughout the course of slavery, and yet it's also been in many ways reclaimed and also somewhat appropriated. Do you think that's a word that would ever appear in the dictionary just because it still has its original meaning, especially when conjugated in a certain way? But it also can have a meaning, you know, depending on how you're saying it. It can either be your friend. It can be a person who, you know, you're in disbelief of. It can have so many different meanings. Have you had to address or approach the N-word at all?
Yeah, no, it comes up from time to time. We haven't had a conversation in our group about whether or not this particular word should be included. It's controversial for many reasons. And one of the reasons has to do with the fact if you take any ethnic group within the United States, any ethnic minority, there are terms that are used that are derogatory to refer to that group. And insiders to that group will often use the term among themselves, potentially even as a sign of endearment under certain circumstances. That often leads to great confusion as to the perception of who can say this, who cannot say this, especially when controversy is over. Is it politically correct to use this word or not correct? Some of your younger listeners will say, oh, well, if this particular word is pronounced with the final syllable er, that's offensive. But if it's pronounced with the final syllable then that's not offensive. That's part of the linguistic change and evolution that we talk about. But that particular word is still the most derogatory term you can use to refer to a slave descendant or person of African origin in the United States, and especially if you're an outsider to that community. In the age of hip hop, you know, many record labels try to encourage young artists to use that because that kind of linguistic nitroglycerin sold records, right? But, you know, everybody that's listening that's young knows of a rap group, NWA, right?
Right.
And there's another expression, HNIC.
Yep.
And it's complex, right? I've mastered the ability to talk about the most derogatory term that one can use when referring to slave descendants, not even using the euphemism of its initial letter. But that takes skill.
John Baugh, professor of linguistics and African American studies at Washington University in St. Louis, also a member of the advisory board for the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. I feel like we could have this conversation for an hour. I will say on our live stream right now on Instagram at LAS Official, more people than I have seen tune into it yet. Hey. So clearly there is a lot to this.
Hey, let me cry for the Lakers that getting swept. That was hard. That was hard to watch.
We're all crying
together.
I feel
you, LA. I feel you.
Thank you so much, John Baugh. I'm Austin Cross. It is an Air Talk Friday, if ever we had one. When we come back, we're going to talk to a young man who has some thoughts about how his generation is processing daily life. That's coming up on Air Talk.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAS 89.3 and live streaming on Instagram at LAIST Official. That's LAIST Official. I want to thank so many people in that conversation for participating in our last talk about the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. And special props to the Hood Fairy in our chat section holding it down, saying this was a dope convo. Clearly, a lot of people thought so. It's really the place to be. If you have not yet checked out LAIST Official for our live stream, you might be missing out. Gotta say. Earlier this week, the U.S. Surgeon General rang the alarm bells about the toll of social media on adolescent mental health. It's a long-running concern to a lot of people. And one thing here is that Gen Z, and these are people who range from age 11 to 26, Gen Z is much more open to conversations about mental health than past generations. But there's a but here. A recent op-ed in the LA Times questions whether young folks pathologize their feelings a little bit too much. That op-ed was written by a teen, Zach Gottlieb. His piece is titled, "What Gen Z Teens Like Me Are Getting Wrong About Mental Health." He founded the online platform Talk With Zach, and he joins me now. Zach, so great to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's really great to be here.
I can just say we talk so much about Gen Z, and I feel like this is one of the few times we actually got a Gen Zer on, because usually they're in school right about now. So thanks for carving out the time. I just want to kick off by asking about pathologizing feelings. You know, what are some examples of what you are seeing play out that maybe has you a little bit concerned among your peers?
We're definitely having a mental health crisis, and depression and anxiety are real things. But in my piece, I'm talking about something different, where we're labeling normal discomfort as detrimental to our mental health. For example, like I say in my piece, if someone disagrees with you, it's like they're gaslighting you. Or if anyone has the wrong point of view or perspective, then they're toxic. So instead of like, I really want to talk through these situations and trying, like, instead of like talking through situations and trying to understand the other perspective, we kind of run away because we feel like we're supposed to be only hearing perspectives that we want to hear. And instead, I'm like, we should be comfortable hearing things that we don't necessarily agree with. But instead, people are like, I don't agree with this. So, like, you're blocked.
Talking right now with Zach Gottlieb, the author of a recent LA Times op-ed about Gen Z teens and what they might be getting wrong about mental health. And I want to say, to Zach's point, looking at some recent data from about a year ago, 42% of Gen Zers have been diagnosed with mental health conditions. One in four were diagnosed with a mental health condition during the pandemic. And 57% are currently taking medication for their mental health conditions. So it is certainly a real issue. And I don't think that we want to bring make light of that fact at all, because people are certainly out there dealing with some very real challenges. But we should mention, Zach, before we go to break, that you're the son of a psychotherapist. So you're kind of coming from a different sort of background than what your peers might be coming from. Your mother is Lori Gottlieb, who's been on this program actually several times. Talk to us just a little bit about her influence on you in terms of how you coped with your mental health struggles growing up.
It's definitely been a little bit of a different upbringing for me. I was always taught to get comfortable with discomfort, which I think is such an important skill because it's really helped me cope when things don't necessarily go my way. Like say like it's like a breakup or something like that, or maybe I'm literally just like anxious about a test. But when something isn't going perfectly fine, I know that that's okay. It's just a part of life.
Talking right now with Zach Gottlieb, author of an LA Times piece looking at Gen Z and what they might be getting wrong about mental health. And I would love to hear from you if you've observed anything about Gen Z or if you are a member of Gen Z, but how have you seen them process the world around them? Are you at all concerned that they might be, you know, not dealing with the issues as they should? 866-893-5722 is the number. Again, that's 866-893-5722. I want to bring in Joshua Coleman as well. Joshua Coleman is a clinical psychologist who's based in the Bay Area. And he's also the author of several books. One of them is Rules of Estrangement, Why Adult Children Cut Ties and How to Heal the Conflict. So Joshua, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great topic.
I mean, one big thing here is that past generations were certainly less understanding of mental health and therapy. I mean, I know growing up that I didn't really learn the words to describe my feelings, things like noting how you're feeling or just observing your feelings. These are things that I did not learn until maybe my early 30s. But Gen Z is much more open to it. Talk to me about this concept that Zach was touching on about how people might be, you know, watching a video on social media and thinking, oh yeah, I'm being gaslit, or, you know, maybe self-diagnosing. Is this a challenge that you're running into as a professional?
Yeah, I think Zach has really put his finger on something really important. And part of this has to do with the way that over the past four decades or so, we parents have become much more anxious about getting our children into the what looks like the narrow bottleneck towards a successful adult life. So our parenting has become much more anxious. We're more guilt-ridden. We're more preoccupied with our children. We're more surveilling of them. We're more intrusive. So at prior generations, like I'm a boomer parent, you know, my parents were more likely to have made the mistake of not being involved enough. I would say generations since then have made the mistake of being too involved. And part of what that's done that I think Zach is pointing to is that it makes these emotions in some ways too important, that as Zach is saying, it often is just better to accept a feeling and look at it rather than give it a diagnosis, rather than to assume it comes from some kind of a flaw or malady or something that needs to be medicated or avoided through cutting off people. And we do not only ourselves a disservice, but we also do our relationships to other people a disservice, because there's this idea that, well, if we were perfect or they were, we wouldn't have all these uncomfortable feelings. Yet, uncomfortable feelings are just part of being human.
We are live streaming right now on Instagram at LAist Official, and Shay Huffman has commented and says, I'm a school psychologist, and I definitely see this with some students who can over-identify with a diagnosis or start self-diagnosing based on what they see on social media. Joshua Coleman, I want to ask you about that because I understand that some people have maybe, you know, touched on something. Like I follow a lot of, say, the high-functioning channels on Instagram, people who have autism and things like that, and I see that people maybe don't realize that their tendencies fall into the autism spectrum until they watch a video, or the ADHD spectrum until they watch a video and they realize, oh, I'm not the only person who deals with this. So I can see that there could be a benefit to this increased social connection. But just in the brief amount of time that we have left, I want to focus in on this, and that's how we, as a general population, how we can help Gen Z develop those healthy coping mechanisms and just help Gen Z out in general, because again, 57% currently taking medication for their mental health condition. How do we help Gen Z out?
Well, I think Zach has really put his finger on it, that a lot of the key is learning how to accept painful feelings and not to assume that they come from something deeper or more flawed about you. I mean, part of the comfort of a diagnosis is feeling like, well, it's not my fault. You know, that's my ADD, or that's my autism, or that's my anxiety disorder. But often it's just, that's just your humanity. We're all fundamentally flawed. We don't have a perfect system or psychology. And so yeah, on any given day, we're likely to feel uncomfortable feelings. So relegating those to a diagnosis is highly problematic. And so just learning how to tolerate feelings, to accept them, to see them as a part of life, to, as Zach is saying, don't cut off people, try to work towards conflict. Don't assume every conflict means that it's you're being traumatized or that that person is abusing you. Assume good intentions. I think those things are really key.
Talking right now with Joshua Coleman, clinical psychologist, and it's all based on an op-ed by Zach Gottlieb about what Gen Z teens might be getting wrong about mental health. And Zach, we only have about 30 seconds left, but I want to hear it from the mouth of a Gen Zer. What does Gen Z need from the older generations? What kind of support would they like to see just based off of the people you've talked to?
I'd love to see people honestly just listen. Like, you don't have to solve our problems, but just be patient and understanding, and don't try to talk us out of our feelings, because when you do, then it doesn't feel normalized. I really want to normalize this discomfort, and I want Gen Z to be able to sit with our feelings and understand that they're 100% normal.
Just listen. Words from Zach Gottlieb, his piece, What Gen Z Teens Like Me Are Getting Wrong About Mental Health. We also heard from Joshua Coleman, clinical psychologist. I'm Austin Cross. This is Air Talk. It's a Friday. Thank you so much for joining us today. Film Week coming at you next. Stick around.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, with critics Claudia Puig, who's the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association and program director for the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. We also welcome to Film Week Manuel Betancourt, who's contributing editor at Film Quarterly. Manuel, it's great to have you with us doing your first reviews on Film Week.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get right into this week's movies, beginning with the live-action adaptation of The Little Mermaid, starring Halle Berry. Rob Marshall, the veteran of musical films, directs. David McGee is the screenwriter. Claudia, what did you think of the live-action The Little Mermaid?
Well, the original one from 1989 was pretty perfect, so it's kind of hard to top perfection or even come close to perfection. And of course, it sort of kicked off the start of the Disney animation renaissance, you know, and afterwards we had Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and Lion King. This is definitely not better than the original. It doesn't tarnish the memory of it either, but my biggest problem, well, I have a few problems, but one is that it's 2 hours and 15 minutes long. The original was 83 minutes, which was perfect.
Now you're talking.
Yeah, right? So that's the sweet spot. It could have gone to 90 minutes, adding a little backstory, but no more than 90, maybe 95 max. So they added some narrative heft, but I'm not sure that was necessary, like a backstory. Like, turns out that Ursula and Triton are brother and sister. They've had this familial feud. Okay, who cares? And, you know, okay, and then Ariel and Eric did form a more substantial connection. Okay, that's maybe a little better, but I personally don't think any of the Disney reboots are all that particularly necessary, but and this one is a little better than some of the others, so it's pretty fun. The original story beats are there. The core remains the same. It made me want to go back and watch the original, which is maybe not what they're... Maybe that's what they're
which
wanting
stands
to
up to multiple viewings.
It definitely does.
If you have kids, it's mandatory.
Yes. Well, I can't even count how many times I've seen it with my daughters, but that the underwater portions were actually visually quite stunning. The vibrancy of the undersea life and the neon coral. The scale is a little confusing, but I thought Halle Bailey did a perfectly good job as Ariel. She has a really good voice. Sebastian, voiced by David Diggs, was great, and Melissa McCarthy was fun as Ursula. Javier Bardem was kind of fun as Triton. It's great hair. But as far as the new music, it was very not memorable, which right. is too bad. The old music was great.
We're talking about The Little Mermaid, starring Halle Bailey, the film directed by Rob Marshall, written by David McGee. Manuel, what did you think?
Yeah, I fall very much similarly with Claudia in that it is a high bar to cross when you have 1989's film to sort of stack against. To me, for example, I find that the decision to go very photorealistic with its character design, so like the Sebastian looks like an actual crab and Flounder looks like a very sickly actual flounder.
Yes,
and so
great.
While you have these like fantastic actors like Divi Diggs and Awkwafina doing amazing voice work, the expressivity that they have in the actual characters can't match them. So it just feels very incongruent. It sort of takes you out. I will say I have not been able to get Part of Your World out of my head since I watched it, which is a testament to sort of that amazing song and Halle Bailey's sort of performance, which is fantastic. And I think it's sort of the saving grace of the film. But to me, all the narrative tweaks that they do, puts it, like, it makes it a little bit more convoluted than it needs to be. They paint themselves into a lot of plot corners that it really can't get out. And I don't know. It just made me want to rewatch the original.
We're talking about the Little Mermaid live action adaptation of the beloved animated version, Rob Marshall directing. It's rated PG and it's in wide release. Nicole Holofcener's new comedy, You Hurt My Feelings, stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tobias Menzies. It's the latest from Holofcener, the writer and director, who's a critic's favorite. Manuel, what did you think of You Hurt My Feelings?
I love this movie. And part of it is because I'm a writer. So the plot, which follows this sort of novelist who finds out that her husband actually doesn't care for her work, felt a little close to home in the sense that you're always going to be a little bit protective about your work and your talent. And, you know, Julie Louis-Dreyfus plays this novelist and how she slowly unravels as she finds this out. And sort of it creates a sort of crisis of faith in her own talent, but also in her marriage and in her trust issues. And, you know, as all of Holofcener's films, it's sort of really small and it focuses on sort of very human foibles that sort of end up rippling out. Sort of her relationship with her husband is strained, but also her relationship with her son and with her friend and her sister. Like, it just, I don't know, it just bowled me over because no one does wry melancholy and, you know, dry exasperation quite like Louis-Dreyfus. And so she carries this film and I just loved it. It's a lovely mix of drama and comedy and it felt like a warm blanket when I was watching it.
By the way, our John Horn talks with Nicole Holofcener later this hour on Film Week. We're talking about her film, You Hurt My Feelings. Claudia.
I agree 1,000% with Manuel. I loved this movie so much. You rarely see smart, perceptive adult comedies about family relationships. There's another one that we'll be discussing later, which is the polar opposite. She's so perceptive about the human condition and how people really feel and really act. And while it may feel small, she knows that this is not, you know, these are first world problems in a way, but it's not, she takes that in stride and she kind of has some playfulness with her, the way she looks at the human condition. You feel like you've crawled into these people's skins and you've inhabited their lives for a couple hours. And Julie Louis-Dreyfus is amazing. She was so great in Please Set, the other Nicole Holofcener.
Enough Said.
Right. Enough Said, yes. That's right. I'm mixing the two Nicole. I love her so much. She was really great in that. And she is just fantastic in this. And Nicole is just brilliant. She grapples with these complexities and the universal struggles. And she, you know, there's so much meat there. I found myself driving home, took my husband to watch it. And, you know, we were talking about the real issues. At the same time, you're laughing so much. And there's a great subplot with David Cross and Amber Tamblyn, who's his real life wife. They go to Julie Louis-Dreyfus's husband, who is a therapist, Tobias Menzies, and they're just constantly bickering. And they finally get to this point. I probably shouldn't spoil it.
It does have a great payoff.
Oh my God.
Especially because this idea that a therapist would actually be the one who's like not able to communicate stuff to his wife. Adds to sort of another layer.
Yes. Oh my God. All the supporting roles. It's just fantastic. You know, and it sort of like taps into the whole idea of like truth and how much you're willing to tell people. And if you love them, do you tell a white lie? Do you, you know, And then there's a really funny scene in which the therapist is talking to this guy. He thinks the session's gone really well. And then they're on Zoom and he hears him say, "What an idiot." Yeah. And you wonder how many things, you know, happen like that on Zoom during the pandemic, particularly.
Well, I'm so curious if Olive Center's idea for the film comes at all from personal experience.
Yes.
And, as a writer.
Hopefully John Horn will delve into that.
"You Hurt My Feelings" is Nicole Olive Center's new comedy starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. It's rated R, and it's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The Max and HBO documentary Being Mary Tyler Moore looks at her career arc. Of course, she was a co-star of one of the greatest sitcoms of all time, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and then starred in also one of the greatest sitcoms in TV history, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. James Adolphus is the director of the documentary. Claudia.
I like this documentary a lot. Full disclosure, my first job after college was at MTM Productions as Grant a production Tinker, assistant. Grant Tinker was my boss. I never met Mary, but I did meet Grant many times. I was a production assistant there as the first female, so I always say I broke through the glass floor. Anyway, the film, and I also was friends with her sister. She went to high school and grade school with me. So it really resonated personally, but I think even if you don't have personal connections, it will resonate. It's a really loving portrait of someone who broke ground and inspired women, but the film doesn't skirt the darker parts of her life. She, acknowledges her. It's kind of like she's leading you through this because there aren't talking heads per se. There's bits of interviews ranging from Dinah Shore to David Susskind, who is just horribly sexist, and Rona Barrett. Remember Rona Barrett?
Oh, yeah. Gossip columnist.
Yes. Yeah. So, she kind of, she's leading you through her life. And she talks about her diabetes. She talks about her son having died, her sister having died. She was no stranger to adversity. And so it's a loving portrait, but, it also gives you a sense of who she really was. They use so much great archival footage because her husband was the executive producer. I'm sure he had all that. And it covers the highs and lows, I think, quite well.
We're talking about the documentary Being Mary Tyler Moore, directed by James Adolphus. Manuel.
Yeah, I think this is a loving documentary and it's a lovely portrait. I think one of the things that you also really get because they have access to so much archival footage is seeing scenes from the Dick Van Dyke Show and seeing scenes from Mary Tyler Moore Show and actually seeing how great of a comedienne she was and how much she worked at it and how much it really meant to her to really live up to the kind of role that she's been sort of enshrined as one of the great television, icons of the 20th century. I think the documentary sort of then stumbles a little bit when she stops the Mary Tyler Moore. I think that the third act of the documentary, when it gets into sort of her personal stuff, because she was a very private person. She says herself, she was a little bit aloof. She was a little bit disconnected. I found that the moments when I was trying to then paint a portrait of what happened to her after she left sort of show business and after she had to sort of pivot away, because you don't have those sitcom moments and because you don't have, scenes from Ordinary People or scenes even from her like Broadway shows, I found myself sort of straying away, and especially when it kept repeating and telling me that she's not Mary Richards and she was never Mary Richards, and I was like, I get it, I know how actors work, but if you love Mary Tyler Moore, this is a treasure trove, and especially as Claudia says, those interviews and those archival pieces are just fantastic, and I'm sure they're not really, you really won't be able to find them anywhere else.
Did it get into her dramatic performance in Ordinary People?
Yes, it did.
And also how shocking that was for people to see her in a role and to give a performance
to be so dramatic and so cold. It did. And also she did Whose Life Is It Anyway, and that she kind of redeemed herself because she'd been on Broadway.
Breakfast at Tiffany's musical.
Was a real bomb. And so, I think it did get into that. And it also had people like Julie Louis-Dreyfus, speaking of her,
right.
And Felicia Rashad and some others talking about, the impact that she had on them kind of growing up. And Katie Couric,
yeah.
That's why she became a TV news journalist.
Yeah. And then that amazing Oprah moment.
Yes.
Where she, surprised Oprah. And to her, she was just like, Mary Richards was also the reason I'm here.
When Mary Tyler Moore died and we did, the morning that her death was announced, a tribute to her on Air Talk, we had so many women, particularly baby boomer women, call in and talk about how significant her performance as Mary Richards on the Mary Tyler Moore Show was. And it was very powerful to hear that, how many women connected with that character.
It was considered pretty radical at the time to be a woman who wasn't divorced or widowed or wasn't about
away
to get
from
married.
Her hometown.
And to enjoy her life as a successful career person.
Being Mary Tyler Moore, Unrated, the documentary streaming on Max, also on HBO channels. James Adolphus is the director. About My Father, a comedy that stars Sebastian Maniscalco and Robert De Niro, Leslie Bibb and Kim Cattrall are in the cast. Laura Taruso directed. The screenplay was written by Maniscalco and Austin Earle. Manuel, what'd you think of About My Father?
This is, I will admit, this is not my kind of comedy, and Maniscalco has never been sort of my kind of comedian. But I will say, I was charmed at parts. So Maniscalco plays sort of a version of himself as this sort of Italian-American guy who's getting ready to propose to his girlfriend, Leslie Bibb. And the big hurdle is he needs to get the ring from his father, played obviously by Robert De Niro, in full meet the parents, bad grandpa, analyze this kind of mode. And of course, he's a little bit curmudgeonly and doesn't really think that, Sebastian, this character, will fit in with his girlfriend's very wealthy, kind of conservative parents. The plot ends up hinging on the father and son spending the July 4th weekend with her family. And then, of course, hijinks ensue because this Italian immigrant father may not be able to sort of fit in.
Hold that thought. We'll come back to it and pick up on About My Father, a comedy starring Sebastian Maniscalco and Robert De Niro. You're listening to Film Week on LA's 89.3. More from Claudia and Manuel when we come right back.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on LA's 89.3. Larry Mantle joined by critics Manuel Betancourt and Claudia Puig. We're hearing about the comedy About My Father, directed by Laura Taruso, starring Sebastian Maniscalco and Robert De Niro. Manuel was just telling us about it before the break. Claudia, what did you think?
I was not charmed. Not at all.
I don't want to hear about his father.
The requisite hilarity did not ensue. this is essentially, a much less funny Meet the Parents meets a much less engaging Big Fat Greek Wedding with a dash of Low Rent Wedding Crashers thrown in. I just thought it was corny, cliched, cartoonish, comedy-free. I decided to write down how many times I laughed. I laughed 1.5 times.
Mm-hmm. What's a half laugh? You have to demonstrate.
Like a little, it's like a chuckle to yourself.
Yeah, not a ha-ha, but a ha. and the other problem, it's so kind of cliched, the whole Sicilian-Italian thing. I don't find him particularly charming. I thought he was kind of wooden. I feel like it makes me really want to see the new movie that Robert De Niro has, Killers of the Flower Moon, because I hear it's fantastic and I need to wipe this memory out of my head.
That's the new Scorsese film that debuted at Cannes, right?
Exactly, and it's been getting rave reviews. It's not as bad as Dirty Grandpa, but that's a very low bar. I just feel like when it comes to comedy, De Niro picks really bad things, very forget about it, there's like lines, like they talk about one of the family members being William Love Collins the 11th, and then Sebastian says, well, the only Italians I know with number after their names are the Popes and Rocky Balboa, and that's not funny. I think contrasting it with Nicole Holofcener, who's so subtle and so clever,
There is nothing subtle here. Everything is broad. The comedy
is broad. So broad.
And it is so. The one thing that did drive me a little bit nuts was the amount of voiceover.
Like, yes, so, I hated that.
And he's doing the voiceover. And so it feels like it's trying to paper over a
lot of Sebastian's voiceover.
So he's telling us about his father and telling us about the, and he's constantly sort of telling us why we should be laughing as opposed to asking us to laugh.
Yeah. And there's just a haircutting scene with Kim Cattrall where he's a hairdresser and, oh, he accidentally cut off all her hair. And it was just
she didn't notice.
Yeah, she didn't notice until the very end goes, oh my God. I don't know. It's just, and then these people are pushing 50. They're like 48 and 49. Why do they need the parents' blessing? They're like, I don't know. If they'd been in their 20s, I might have forgiven it a bit more. But.
About My Father, the comedy is in wide release. It's rated PG-13. T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets stars Ray Fiennes. The film's directed by Sophie Fiennes. It's unrated. Manuel.
Right. So Four Quartets is obviously one of the greatest modernist poems of the 20th century written by T.S. Eliot. And so what this is a filmed production, a film stage production, where Ray Fiennes recites the entire poem with little else than two chairs on stage and with some sort of lighting. It's very minimalist. He is, as anyone who's seen him on stage or on screen, he has a beautiful voice. He's a venerable dramatic actor, and he really sort of captures the spirit of this poem that's about modernity and time and sort of these like larger questions about nature and humanity. It's really engrossing if poetry read on stage is your thing. And I, you know, I'm an academic. I went to grad school. I wrote a lot of dissertations on like modernism and postmodernism. So this was sort of very much my thing. I know that telling people that, you know, an hour and a half of Ray Fiennes reading modernist poetry with little else other than like some shots of nature, maybe a hard sell, but I just find, you know, when you get lost in Eliot's words, it can be very moving. And sort of, I was just reminding of the power of poetry. And that to me is something we don't get a lot of. So I'm probably a little bit more generous than most.
Manuel, was this just filming one of the performances that he did on tour throughout the UK? Or was this done more as a film experience independent of that? I don't know if I'm making that clear.
Yeah, no, it seems this is clearly a filmed production. I don't know if they did it while he was actually performing it. I'm trying to remember, but I don't think we don't get shots of the audience, and I don't think it was shot with an audience.
So this was special for the film, but essentially what theater goers saw.
Exactly. Yes. All right. With a couple more close-ups.
T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets is in select theaters and it's unrated. The Hole in the Fence, a drama mystery. The film is directed and co-written by Joaquin Del Paso. Claudia, please tell us about The Hole in the Fence.
I was very mesmerized by this film. I think the director, Joaquin Del Paso, has a way with visuals and atmosphere. You feel this disturbing ominousness of the story from kind of the start. I thought it was a smart and disturbing thriller, pretty artfully made. It opens with this kind of bucolic scene, and it's never going to be bucolic quite like that again. There are children coming to, or young kids, like maybe
teens.
Early teens, yeah. Adolescents, yeah. You know, coming to this religious camp in Mexico, and they are berated, they're mocked, they're taunted, they're bullied by the adults that are there. There's racism, there's homophobia, there's cruelty, there's sadism, but it happens in a very sort of slow moving way. It's done really well. You get the sense of ominousness. It can be stomach churning at certain points. There's some really beautiful scenes where they're standing at windows. There's a scene where all the boys are gathered standing at this window and there's like this helicopter taking off, and it's kind of an indelible image because you know something bad is going to happen. You've always had that feeling that something terrible is going to happen. And that, I'm not going to give anything away, but there's a final scene of a little boy at the side of a road that just kills you. I really thought this was very intriguing. I think he's a really talented filmmaker.
We're talking about The Hole in the Fence. It's a Mexican production.
It is a Mexican
well?
Production set. Well, it's a co-production between Mexico and Poland.
Oh.
And at first I was thinking, was The Woods, I thought, was a shot in Poland. But then they go into the town and it's clearly in Mexico.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's all in Spanish.
Yes.
What did you think, Manuel, of The Hole in the Fence?
Yeah, I think to me, intriguing is a great word. And it's very much big on mood, right? So it's these, it's supposed to be this getaway where boys become men, right? And it's sort of like a controlled Lord of the Flies environment, like that they really want a kind of savagery and a kind of like primal masculinity to come through, which is, of course, terrifying when you get, you know, a bunch of teenagers who are just egging each other on to be more violent, to be more sort of rough and rugged with one another and stomping down on people who look different and act different and are emotional. To me, it never quite ends up building as well as I would like it. I think it's sort of like a lot of premise and a lot of setup. And then I didn't never quite know where it wanted me to land or where it wanted me to take me with all these provocative images, all these provocative scenes, a lot of scenes that do make you want to turn away, make you like run for the hills and not the hills that they're up and some other hills probably. But yeah, intriguing and mesmerizing. But I don't know if it all sort of adds up, especially
with
the final.
I kind of agree. Yeah, I'm not sure it came together. I think he's clearly trying to say something about class and entitlement. But yeah, maybe it stopped short of really coming together. But I feel like this is a talent that it will be really interesting to watch.
Yeah.
The film is The Hole in the Fence. It's unrated and it's at Lemley's Glendale Theater. The mystery drama Reality stars Sydney Sweeney and Josh Hamilton, film directed by Tina Satter, who co-wrote the screenplay with James Paul Dallas. Manuel, what did you think of Reality?
This is a fascinating film. So this takes place almost in real time, and it takes us back to, you know, June 2017, when Reality winner, this 25-year-old, was confronted in front of her Georgia house by two FBI agents who then will, as we know if you followed the story back then, will arrest her, and then she'll eventually be convicted of espionage and having smuggled out documents that prove that there had been some interference into election ballots from some Russian malware. What's fascinating is that the entire film, it's taken from the audio transcript that the FBI agents recorded that day. So word by word, all you're watching is exactly what happened. But of course, Sydney Sweeney, who, you know, is in Euphoria in The White Lotus, gets a chance to sort of give us texture to what it is that was happening and how Reality, that's her name, slowly reveals why it is she gave these documents to the press, why she felt the need to sort of bend, like, go outside the law to do so, because she felt a commitment to sort of freedom of the press and that we should know these things. So it's this like three-hander of these two officers trying to get all this information and trying not to reveal her hand. And it's so fascinating. And it constantly reminds you that this is a transcript, that this is actually what happened, that this is actually, because it almost feels too perfect and it almost feels like a play. And Sweeney is fantastic. I think she's one of the best actresses of her generation. Like the thing she does with Reality, and the way she slowly sort of unravels and tells us about it, it's just mesmerizing, and I love her.
We're talking about the drama Reality. It's streaming on Max, formerly known as HBO Max. Sydney Sweeney stars, Tina Satter, the director and co-screenwriter. It's unrated. Also this week, I'm Not Crazy, I'm Sick, a documentary about Lyme disease, directed by L. Brooks Tao. Claudia, what did you think?
This is an example of the documentaries that we've had a fair amount of on the show, where they're about an important subject and intriguing on the face of it, but not terribly well made. So, you know, separating that out is important, I guess. So it's pretty comprehensive. It's about Lyme disease. It profiles several people who have suffered from it. It shows the havoc that it wreaks on their lives, people who go undiagnosed. It shows how it isn't, you know, insurance doesn't cover the treatments. It's one of the producers, executive producers, is a person whose daughter had it. It's interesting in that it feels very... it just doesn't feel terribly well made as a documentary. However, the cinematographer, Claire Popkin, was the person who shot Free Solo. So I'm not quite sure why this isn't. Maybe it's just because it's a lot of talking heads and a lot of information. So that kind of bogs it down. This certainly doesn't have, obviously, the vertiginous cliff drops or any of that. So, you know, if it's a subject that you find really interesting, if there's a personal connection. What I did find interesting statistically was that it's the fastest growing infectious disease in the U.S. There are 476,000 new Lyme cases emerging each year. That's more than HIV/AIDS. That's more than West Nile virus, more than malaria combined. So, you know, and there's still many doctors who don't think it's real. It didn't really explore that enough. I mean, it was very definitely on the side of, you know, this is a real thing. So I guess I would have liked a little bit more from the opposing side.
I'm Not Crazy, I'm Sick. The documentary is on demand starting next Tuesday. It's unrated. Kandahar, an action thriller starring Gerard Butler. The film's directed by Rick Roman Waugh, Mitchell LaFortune, the screenwriter. Manuel, what'd you think of Kandahar?
I did not care for this film. Part of it is that if I tell you that this is a film starring Gerard Butler and it's an action thriller, you probably know exactly what you're getting. And you sort of do. So he's playing this sort of undercover CIA operative who finds himself, as so often happens in these films, you know, doing one last job in Afghanistan that, of course, goes awry and, you know, everything starts going wrong when his cover is blown and he needs to find a way to get himself and his translator out of harm's way, and they need to get to Kandahar. So what's interesting, sort of interesting, is that this kind of boilerplate thriller is set amidst, you know, the U.S. having pulled out of Afghanistan and sort of what that power vacuum created in this region. Sort of it's flirting with the sort of geopolitical crisis that's happening, and it feels like it's trying to give us some nuance about that, and you know his allegiance is sort of hard to parse out, and but you know, at the end of the day, it's all he's trying to blow stuff up and get out of harm's way and shoot a bunch of people that don't look like him, and eventually I'm not gonna spoil everything, but I think you could probably gather where the movie ends up arriving. And so there are some sort of intense action sequences and some thrilling moments, but you know, at the end of the day, this is a Gerard Butler vehicle. So if that's the kind of thing that you enjoy, I think like this is not going to disappoint. Right.
Remember the beginning of his career? He was so interesting back in his early Scottish indie days. What happened?
Yeah. Kandahar is the film. It's rated R and it's in wide release. We're just about done. Just quick, Influencer starring Emily Tennant. Manuel, we're seeing it all. Just quick thought on it.
Just quick. This is sort of a thriller about a woman who's targeting influencers in Thailand and maybe offing them.
Yes or no?
I'm a no on it.
All right. Influencer is unrated and it's available on multiple streaming services. We'll continue on Film Week coming up. We'll be talking about the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival. Carlos Aguilar, the film critic, will be joining us. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3, joined by critics Claudia Puig and Manuel Betancourt, and making a trio of critics is Carlos Aguilar, freelance film critic who every year covers the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival, which takes place over next weekend, starting on Thursday the 31st. Carlos, very good to have you with us to talk about some of the most interesting films to be screened. We appreciate it. First of all, just a general thought about the importance of this festival before we get to specific movies.
Right, yeah. I mean, this is, you know, the most important gathering of Latino, you know, films in the city. And I think that what has turned it into such an important, film festival is the fact that they really put forward U.S. Latino filmmakers, making this sort of difference between filmmakers from Latin America and U.S. Latino filmmakers. They do include, you know, all films from, you know, Argentina, Mexico, and all over the continent. but they sort of have a special place for those stories by Latinos in the U.S., which tend to be underrepresented at festivals. And so I think that the program that they put out every year kind of combines stories from, you know, both sort of sides of the Latino spectrum and within those two sides, sort of the different countries and experiences that, you know, that comprise this sort of like very large umbrella that is the Latino experience.
Where is the venue this year for the festival?
I believe it's the same as it's been in past years, which is the Chinese theaters in Hollywood.
All right, very good. Well, let's talk about Flaming Hot. This is a film that's gotten a lot of attention, directed by Eva Longoria. The story of Richard Montañez, I know there's been a lot of controversy as to whether he really was the discoverer of the Flaming Hot Cheetos and originated it. He worked at Frito-Lay. What did you think of this fictionalized account of his story?
I mean, I think it's definitely a movie that wants to be a crowd pleaser and wants to sort of honor the legacy of this man without getting into, you know, the controversy or sort of like being too, you know, kind of it wants to be sort of more work as an homage rather than get into the nitty gritty of what really happened and whatnot. And I think that, you know, the lead performance by Jesse Garcia as Richard Montañez is sort of really engaging and kind of charming in an interesting way. I think that, you know, Eva Longoria as a director shows promise in this, and I think that's interesting. I do feel that that the controversy around it might sort of kind of overshadow the film in a way. But it's playing at the festival, and it might be one of the few times people will get to see it on the big screen, because this one is premiering directly on Hulu later in June. So this is sort of like its big screen showing after premiering at the Southwest Southwest Festival earlier this year.
And really big screen, because it's going to be at the TCL IMAX screen for Flamin' Hot. That'll be coming up Wednesday next week at 7 o'clock. The Other Shape, an animated film from Colombia and Brazil, directed by Diego Felipe Guzman. What did you think of The Other Shape?
This is a really peculiar animated film. I think in general, it's still kind of rare to see animated features from Latin America. It's still not a region where animation is as prominent as, you know, say, Europe or Japan. So anytime we get a chance to see an animated feature from Latin America, it's sort of like a special treat. This one's a psychedelic, hand-drawn universe in which every human wants to turn their head into a square, like a little square, so they wear these binders to sort of like force their bodies to turn into a square. And of course, it's sort of like a kind of like an easy metaphor for like fitting in and, you know, kind of like abiding by societal rules. But it's a movie that has no dialogue. So it really works in a visual manner. And the animation is really peculiar and unique. So I found this one kind of like a rather peculiar entry into the options of the festival.
We're talking about from South America, the animated feature, The Other Shape. That's screening next Friday, June 2nd at 9:15 at the TCL Chinese Theaters. Claudia, you also wanted to mention a film that you programmed for the Santa Barbara International Festival, Manuela.
Yeah, just a quick note. It won our jury award for best Spanish language Latin American film, Manuela. And it feels very timely. It's about, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give too much away, but it's about a nanny and something she experiences. And it's just, it feels very of the moment and it's very well made.
All right, Manuela. Also, we have Daughter of Rage, a Nicaraguan film that is written and directed by Laura Bauermeister. What did you think of that, Carlos?
Yeah, this one is a sort of a naturalistic coming-of-age movie, and it's been heralded as the first Nicaraguan movie directed by a Nicaraguan woman. In the past, there have been other fiction films directed and made in Nicaragua, but by European filmmakers. So this one is sort of the first one by a native Nicaraguan woman. And so it tells the story of this young 11-year-old girl who works at a landfill, sort of, you know, finding things and lived with her mom, and somehow they came into possession of this litter of pit bull dogs, and they're trying to sell them to sort of like gain some money and fix their house. But of course, circumstances sort of change the course, the trajectory of their lives. And, you know, the young actress, Ara Alejandra Medal, who plays Maria, the lead in this film, is really great. And so I think it's an opportunity to see a film from a country in Latin America that we so rarely have gotten to see any stories from.
All right, Daughter of Rage, Nicaraguan film. It's next Saturday, June 3rd, 5:15 in the afternoon, TCL Chinese Theaters. Also recommended, Hope Soledad, a film from Mexico, which screens next Saturday, 2:30 in the afternoon, TCL Chinese. Carlos Aguilar, thank you so much. We have more to come on Film Week on LA. It's 89.3 in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. You Hurt My Feelings is the latest film from writer-director Nicole Holofcener. Her previous movies include Please Give, Lovely and Amazing, Friends with Money, and Enough Said. That film starred Julia Louis-Dreyfus and the late James Gandolfini. Well, Louis-Dreyfus and Holofcener team up again for the new film, You Hurt My Feelings. It also co-stars Tobias Menzies. LAist entertainment reporter John Horn talked with Holofcener about her latest project.
I want to ask you first about overheard conversations, which is a fulcrum in this film. There's an author in your film, played by Julie Louis-Dreyfus, and she overhears her husband, who is a therapist, talk about how he really doesn't like her writing. And she overhears this, obviously, without his knowledge. And it's a turning point in the film and kind of a turning point in their relationship. Was that something, because so much of your stories are inspired by things that happened to you or your friends, is that drawn from some sort of personal experience?
You know, I have to say, thankfully, it's not. But it is one of my greatest fears. And, of course, I think that people are lying to me. So, I mean, not all the time, but some of the time. I worry that they're lying to me. I think I can tell when they're lying to me, and it's humiliating. And sometimes I wish they would just tell me the truth. It's like, just come on, I can tell you didn't like it. Maybe you liked the last one, or maybe not. But no one's ever going to say that. And it was just a fear that something like that could happen. And I'm sure it has happened. I just don't know about it. I'm sure. That many of my loved ones prefer one movie or over another, or, you know, think they're crap or whatever. But that's kind of what made me want to explore this topic.
So many years ago, not that many, when I was working at the LA Times, I was going down the stairwell and I was behind a fellow reporter and her editor. And it was two flights and they didn't know I was behind them. And they spent the entire two flights, or this reporter, she spent the entire two flights trashing my work and just went on and on and on. And I decided not to say anything, but it definitely colored my relationship in working with this person going forward. It was like unbelievable.
And it was total, like they just trashed you.
Yes. Anyway, that is, I know how damaging it can be personally, but your situation is different because it is a husband and wife talking.
I just remembered one. I was screening a short film that I had made at NYU, and I thought it was, you know, pretty terrific movie. I was really proud. Everyone told me how great it was, and someone behind me said something like, "When is this going to end?" It was devastating. And then later, my stepfather actually said that, you know, maybe I should have a plan B after he saw that movie as well. So that I wasn't so happy about that.
I can imagine.
And I'm really glad that I got better.
I'm going to ask you about adjectives, because they're very important to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character. She sees dust jacket blurbs, and what other people get is a blurb perilously close to perfect. What she gets isn't quite as nice. It's a terrific read.
Right.
And that feels like anybody in the creative enterprise looking at quotes of their own work. Is that something that that is personal to you about blurb quotes, perilously close to perfect. I don't know if that's a real saying, but it sure could be.
It was, believe it or not.
Was it about your film?
Yes.
Aw.
And it was thrilling. And I thought, oh, I have to put this in, because who would ever believe that? And if it hadn't been written about one of my films, I would just want to kill the person who got that quote. Yeah, of course I look at quotes, and I'm very choosy about the quotes that go on my own work. And I mean, I'm really kind of making fun of myself.
So the last time you directed a movie that you wrote was probably a decade ago, right?
Uh-huh.
So a lot can happen in 10 years. How much of life experience is reflected in this film? And was there something that happened to you that made you want to go back? I mean, all of your films outside of Land of Steady Habits were written by you. Was that experience interesting, but you felt you had more stories to tell? What about the switch back to things that are vaguely autobiographical, inspired by life, whatever we want to say there?
Completely inspired by life, and autobiographical in a non-literal way, for sure. Well, I don't make movies very often, and I don't have a lot of ideas that stick with me, so I love the opportunity to direct somebody else's stuff. I've been trying to write my own screenplay since Enough Said, and I think I actually did write one, but I didn't like it. And this one took a long time to finally find its place, and it took a long time to make it good. But those are the ones that I love doing the most. And I don't really think about what's happened in the last 10 years or how I've matured or blah, blah, blah. It's more just writing about me and now and the things that are curious for me, are interesting, inspiring, embarrassing, my worst fears, my friends' lives, and some of them questioning, you know, this is, you know, I don't have many years left. I'm not even middle-aged anymore, beyond. And am I doing anything that has meaning? Of course, I ask myself those questions. Everyone I know asks them. So it was very close to home.
When you said it wasn't easy to write, what was the mm-hmm. biggest creative obstacle in terms of putting the story together? What was the nut to crack?
Well, it was a completely different story at one point that I got sick of writing, but it was kind of a Julia character. And then I wrote it with the male character. Tobias's character had a very different job and a different character, and I wasn't happy with that. And neither were financiers. I don't know. It just took me forever. And, you know, I did The Last Duel, and I did some television shows and all that. So I was busy. And there you go. I mean, I'm not prolific, and I'm generally not a fast writer. Or I might write a first draft quickly, but it's a mess.
I'm going to ask you about casting, because I think there are a couple of actors with whom you hadn't worked before.
Yeah.
Some you had. Mm-hmm. What does that do to you as a filmmaker? You obviously have people you work with over the years. When there's somebody new thrown into the mix, how does that challenge you as a storyteller? And what do you learn from that actor who hasn't done movies with you before?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I have to learn how they like to be directed. And not all actors are the same. And I've been really fortunate that the actors I've cast, and I don't know why, kind of all work the same way. Nobody demands an enormous amount of rehearsal. Nobody demands a big binder full of backstory. They are intuitive. They seem to get the script. We rehearse a little, and we have fun. And they like to be directed. I have had on occasion, mostly on television shows, when I don't know how the actors like to be directed or if they like to be directed, I've been snapped at. Been given stink eye. Some actors I can say, try it happier. Seriously, because they know where I'm coming from.
Right.
You know, maybe you're happy hearing this, maybe you're not. Let's try it lots of different ways. And some actors will stare at me like, are you seriously giving me that direction? And then I feel like an idiot.
There's a literary agent in the film who says of Julie Louis-Dreyfus's writing, you're not a new voice,
mm-hmm.
which is something that is said in this business a lot, and it's just, it's not even like hidden. It's just pure ageism. Like if you're a certain age, you don't have a story to tell, and that story isn't relevant to anybody.
I know, John, you know, we're right on the edge. We might be out of a job pretty soon. Our voices are older.
But it's not anything to do with the quality of the story. No. The story could be written by a 12-year-old. It's the author. And the assumption is that somebody of a certain age can only tell a certain kind of story.
Right.
Obviously, your films are about people who tend to be your contemporaries in terms of age. Mm-hmm. But older directors can do stories about younger people, and younger directors, look at Sarah Polley in Away From Her, can do stories about people who are much older than her.
Yeah, and men can direct movies about women beautifully, and women can direct movies about men beautifully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think in that tiny comment, you're saying a lot about how people are seen as artists, that there's only a certain kind of way that you are seen, and if you're not seen as the thing that people want, you're not valued.
Right, right. I mean, I don't get sent thrillers to direct. I'd love to direct a thriller, but I get sent scripts that resemble my own. And, you know, I love making those kind of movies, but I'd love to do something different.
Every film has a scene or a moment that doesn't quite fit, that you hold on to near and dear, and either it's superfluous or it just doesn't make the edit. What is that scene in this film?
Well, of course, I don't think it is, but I know what it is. I mean, it's the scene in the doctor's office, right? Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that have to do with anything? And yet I wanted to show that Julia's character does love her mother and does take care of her. She might be a whack job, infuriating, frustrating, but she's there for her. And especially in the following scene when they're at the coffee shop and she grabs her hand, I wanted some warmth between the two women. And, I did read a review recently where someone said, I think you should have cut that scene out. And it was much longer, trust me. I knew enough to trim it.
Nicole, I love hanging out with you and talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's writer-director Nicole Holofcener talking about her latest film, You Hurt My Feelings, which is in theaters now, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. If you missed out on what our critics had to say about that film or any of the others throughout the course of this hour, go to LAist.com. You can listen to full episodes of Film Week anytime or download it wherever you get your podcasts. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend from all of us at Film Week.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.